I'm Nikki Gamer for Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Since shortly after the dawn of the internet age, newspapers that form the core of American news reporting have been hammered. Craigslist undercut classified advertising, thousands of readers stopped subscribing to daily newspapers, and reporting staffs have been cut. All the downsizing has left media watchers wondering what the future of American journalism might be, including here in Baltimore. The Daily Record's parent company filed for bankruptcy last week, and the Baltimore Sun Media Group last month bought our alternative weekly, the City Paper. Today, a look at these stories and at the health of newspapers. Will the internet, as some have predicted, be the end of them? Or can newspapers survive and even thrive in the digital age? First, the news. And welcome to the Midday Show, everyone. I'm Nikki Gamer, in for Dan Rodericks. Dan will be back tomorrow. There have been some shakeups lately among Baltimore's newspapers. Last week, the parent company of the Maryland Daily Record announced it would seek bankruptcy protection. The Daily Record covers legal and business news, and it's been doing so for 125 years. That announcement comes on the heels of another development. Last month, the Baltimore Sun Media Group bought the City Paper, Baltimore's alternative weekly newspaper, since the 1970s. We'll be talking today about the health of the local newspaper industry and the future of American print journalism after a period of downsizing and transition. We welcome now Eric Wemple, who reports and blogs about the news media for The Washington Post. He's the former editor of the D.C. alternative weekly Washington City Paper. Eric Wemple, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start here what I think is the biggest story, the sale of City Papers to the Baltimore Sun Media Group. Tell us the terms of the sale.
Well, the terms of the sale were not 100% disclosed. I kept asking them for numbers and so on and so forth, but those were not disclosed. I would guess that the City Paper sold for a price somewhere in the very low millions. In other words, somewhere in the, you know, maybe 3, 4, 2, 5 million, somewhere in that range. I think it's a pretty healthy and profitable place, but less so than it was in the heyday for the alt weeklies, which was back in the 90s when they, so in the 80s, when they sort of controlled or had as close to a monopoly as you can get on the sort of young crowd that goes out and dines and attends theatrical and entertainment events, and that was what really fueled the business model for the all weeklies. But then, in the past decade or so, a bunch of other competitors have jumped in. But in any case, it wasn't a bad little property. I could see why the Sun wanted to gobble it up, and they did so with some layoffs because there's some redundancies. But there was one, I think, important story in those layoffs.
And tell us, what did you take from that?
Well, you know, they said when they talked to people about this purchase that they would be redundancies, right? That that bringing the Baltimore City Paper into the Baltimore Sun's under its roof, would there be some redundancy? And that sort of makes sense. So there's some circulation redundancy. So they got rid of some people on the business side, the administrative side. But they plucked off Joe McLeod, who
right.
is the longtime creative director of the Baltimore City Paper. I am not a Baltimore resident. I don't read the Baltimore City Paper as much as others. But I've kept track of it. And I've kept track of Joe McLeod. He is, in some way, sort of like the evil genius soul of that paper, the sort of troublemaker without which an alt weekly doesn't really have much of a pulse. And so they pick him off. He's like, as far as I can tell, he's the only major editorial person that they knocked off. And I think that just speaks a whole hell of a lot about what's going on here, which is that the establishment weekly can't handle the edge. Because that's what Joe brought in spades. And as you know, as you may know, he wrote a sort of final column that consisted of nothing but F-bombs, right?
Right.
And the Sun.
I want to stop you for a second. Twitter was full of comments about this after the sale was announced. And one of the major concerns is this question over whether City Paper will be able to keep its independent voice, right? Because they're going to be under this this traditional media company. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think it won't. You know, I mean, well, I mean, it'll be independent to the extent that the Sun allows it, which is already shown. There are already very, very strong limitations on that. Obviously, if you pluck Joe McLeod out of there, the raucous, the rabble rousing is going to be limited right from there, right from the get go. So it's clear that they don't. Well, they want City Paper to be sort of edgy, but not too edgy. So it's lost its soul as far as I can see. That's not to say it won't do good reporting. That's not to say it won't add a helpful voice, but it's not going to be the City Paper. Tom Skoker from Gawker wrote that now Baltimore is going to be a no-newspaper town.
Wow.
And that's a little scary. The thing will continue to exist. It'll continue to do good reporting on and the police beat and, cover culture, but only within the bandwidth of sort of respectability that the Baltimore Sun will allow.
Okay, but the buying of alternative weeklies by traditional media companies is not uncommon, right? This played out, the Chicago Reader was bought by owners of the Sun-Times and Sun-Times Media, and they, from what I read, that publication has remained independent.
It seems that way. I haven't heard a lot of complaints that the Chicago Reader has been hemmed in by this particular purchase. That's a good point. There are other. I believe there's one in Nashville that's owned by an establishment media outlet. Look, these are obviously very, very appealing targets for legacy media outlets because, as I said, they bring this very desirable demographic, young people with a lot of money to spend or a fair amount of money to spend. And so it makes sense that they would buy them. If they tinker too much with them, then they're going to be no good to them anyway. So it makes economic sense for them to respect these outlets. I would argue that it doesn't make economic sense to get rid of a guy like Joe McLeod. I know I'm going back to Joe McLeod again, but, I like him.
Tell us about Van Smith, a City Paper senior staff writer who you wrote about.
Oh, geez, that guy is a monster. You know, he gets into a story and he never lets go of it. I mean, he's deep into Baltimore crime. He's deep into the justice system. He knows the prosecutors. He knows the defense attorneys. And he knows, he knows the prisons. He knows it all. So, as I say, I think that that's one good, valuable, important asset to keep there. I think that's just the sort of edge.
Does he have his job? He's still there.
Yes. Okay. As far as I know, he does. Yeah, I haven't seen him on any of the lists. And they would be crazy, to get rid of him. He probably should have been working for the Sun years ago. That's someone who I think is a valuable player.
And all of the City Paper staffers are now going to be working at the Sun's headquarters on Calvert Street. Is that correct?
That's the way I understand it. They've made the physical move. Once again, it doesn't make much sense for them to work out of separate quarters.
Let's move on now to talk about the Baltimore Sun Media Group. It's owned by the Tribune Company,
right,
which is in the process of spinning off its print portfolio, which includes the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune. And it was rumored at one point that the Koch brothers were interested in this property. What's the latest on who is considering a buy?
Well, that's a really good question because, we heard Aaron Kushner, who is in the OC Register and a very wealthy entrepreneur. We heard the fellow in San Diego, I believe, the Union Tribune, was interested. We've heard the Kochs. The Kochs have since made clear that they are no longer interested, that their particular interest drove a lot of visibility for them. I think they were uncomfortable with the visibility. A lot of it was...
There were some protests about that.
There were some protests. There were lots of discussions at the Los Angeles Times. There were threats of quitting, a walkout, and so on and so forth, which I think probably would have pleased the Koch brothers had they purchased it. But anyhow, that's all in the past now. There hasn't been a lot of chatter of late on who is exactly going to buy this thing, under what terms, and so the Tribune Company is trying to organize its business in such a way, I think, to present it most favorably. They've been trying to... Also, there's another question about their stake in these dot-com ventures, like Classified Ventures, which includes Cars.com, and the Tribune has a stake in these things that's like $700 million strong. It's getting to the point now where these eight huge dailies which, as you said, includes the Sun, the Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times, Orlando Sentinel, they may not even be worth as much as the Tribune's stake in this in these classified .com ventures, which you probably never heard of, or you know, it's like CareerBuilder and Cards.com. So that's a real interesting sign of where we are in the world now, where you know you have all these really famous newspaper titles, and they may not be worth even as much as these somewhat less iconic web properties in which the Tribune has a stake.
Sure. I want to ask you, I'm interested in what you make of these hybrid news outlets. For instance, the Baltimore Brew, you know, they're doing a lot of great investigative journalism in the city. Do you see these as a replacement? Where do these fit in your opinion?
I don't think, you know, I think that it's helpful that they've arrived. I don't know that they will ever fully replace. Maybe in the long term that will be the case. You know, they either have to get funding through nonprofits or do something really crazy and fun with their own business models to keep it going. Here in D.C., for example, the Post has shrunk a lot of its metro coverage over the years. And, you know, whereas there was once, I think, probably maybe four or five beat reporters covering any given institution in the District of Columbia, now there may be one or two. You know, so the really attrition in local news is massive. It's just simply massive in terms of reportorial muscle. I don't know when it's going to make a comeback. I think the problem is that local business, by and large, has gone out of business. You get, you know, your local, whether it's supermarkets or whether it's your department stores in particular, those things are basically gone. So it's all your chain stores, whether it's a Panera or Bed Bath and Beyond, and they simply are too big to work with local publications.
All right. Well, I do have to ask you, you know, we have these billionaires looking at properties. You know, you had Jeff Bezos take over the Post, mm-hmm. and you had John Henry up in Boston. And these people are, you know, kind of look at themselves as wanting to save journalism. Do you see them as bringing game-changing editorial strength to what's happening?
Well, you hope so. You hope so. You hope they can come in and deliver the magic bullet. What we were told here at the Post when Bezos come in is that he didn't have it. And that wasn't the point. The point is to try to grind out a new business model, a new way of looking at things. Bezos has invested in the Post. He's brought on new talent. You know, the newsroom is strong. It is staffing up as we speak. You know, there are all sorts of vacancies and new little teams that they're doing. They also created a new a business plan to get subscribers to other papers around the country to chip in for post subscriptions at a reduced rate. So there's a lot of things that they're doing. Whether they can save this business model, I'm a little skeptical, but I hope that they do.
We just touched on this in the intro, but the Daily Record, its parent
right.
company, filed for bankruptcy, but the Tribune Company just emerged from bankruptcy, so this doesn't necessarily mean the end of that publication.
Right. I mean, there's a Chapter 11 things where they reorganized. I mean, when the Tribune went into bankruptcy, it got a loan, and it really retooled a lot of its operations, and it just gives it a little bit of breathing space, and you know, it's now back out in the world. But they are cutting and cutting and cutting more. I believe that last year they declared that they were going to cut 700 positions to save. I don't know how much it was around the entire company. It was maybe $100 million. So there's still a lot of cutting. I mean, I think that's what bankruptcy basically means for these places now. It's just layoffs and you know, quote unquote restructuring.
Right. As a media watcher, how would you diagnose the health of the Baltimore print industry compared with other American cities?
I don't think it's good. I don't think it doesn't look terribly wonderful to me. And I don't know where it's headed, but I do think that you'll see, I think, perhaps even more consolidation. The Daily Record, the News with the Sun, the News with the City Paper is not a pretty picture, in my view. And I hope that Baltimore proves me wrong on this.
All right. Well, Eric Wemple, it was great speaking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Wemple reports and blogs about the news media for The Washington Post. We have to take our first break here, but when we come back, more on the health of the local newspaper industry. Up next, Tim Franklin, president of the Poynter Institute and a former editor and senior vice president of the Baltimore Sun, joins us. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. Dan will be back tomorrow. This hour, we're talking about the health of our local print newspaper industry and the future of American print media. We're having this conversation because of some recent shakeups among Baltimore's newspapers, and I'm talking about the sale of the City Paper to the Baltimore Sun Media Group. The Tribune Company is also in the process of spinning off its newspaper arm, which includes the Baltimore Sun, the Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times. The Trib is looking to sell its publishing business. For more on all of this, I turn now to Tim Franklin, the president of the Poynter Institute, a school and media strategy center dedicated to journalism. Tim Franklin was the editor and senior vice president of the Baltimore Sun between 2004 and 2008. He's also held positions at Bloomberg News, the Orlando Sentinel, and the Indianapolis Star. Tim Franklin, welcome to the Midday Show.
Thanks, Nikki. It's great to be with you.
All right. So you heard Eric Wemple there. He was pretty pessimistic. What are your thoughts on the health of Baltimore's print media sector compared with how papers are doing in other parts of the country?
Well, it's definitely a challenge, Nikki. I mean, last week, the Pew Center came out with its 2014 State of the Media report. And for journalism junkies, this Pew report is gold. I mean, it's something that we all look forward to every year. And it was really mixed. There was good news and bad news. On the good news side, and in fact, in the very first paragraph of the report, it said that 2013 and 2014 brought a level of energy to the news industry not seen for a long time, that the activities have created a new sense of optimism or perhaps hope for the future of American journalism. And it talked about how that in the past few years, there have now been 5,000 full-time jobs created at digital news organizations. That's a lot of jobs. BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, Politico, Mashable, they all have now very robust newsrooms and news organizations. And then as you talked about in your last segment, you have entrepreneurs like John Henry in Boston and Jeff Bezos in Washington and Pierre Omidyar from eBay making big investments in journalism. So, you know, that's all great news. And a lot of the digital success has been with topical sites like in sports and entertainment, investigative reporting, and international news. But the challenges, you know, are certainly still there, and there are many. I mean, full-time professional newsroom employment was down 6.4% in the most recent study by the American Society of News Editors. There now are about 38,000 jobs in newsrooms nationally. That's the lowest since ASNE's begun keeping statistics. Print advertising has continued to decline, although the pace of that decline has slowed a little bit, and circulation revenue is actually up at a lot of news organizations, in part because they've been charging more for subscriptions. So you know, that's on the national level. It's mixed. I mean, we have a lot of editors who come through Poynter, and they've been through here in the last few weeks. And, you know, a few years ago, you would talk to folks, and it was almost like you were staring at the abyss. You didn't know where the bottom was. Now I think that while there's still a great deal of concern and business models need to be developed, there's a sense that, you know, we could be a year or two away from turning the corner.
Okay. We should stay, and this is something that I was surprised at, that the vast majority of original reporting still comes from the print media, which I didn't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if you just, I mean, the news industry is about a $65 billion industry, and digital right now only makes up about 500 to 700 million of that 65 billion, and the vast majority still comes from print. So print revenue is still by far the largest source of income, and digital only represents like 1/6 of the total revenue of newspapers nationally, if you look at it on average.
Let's separate print from the rest of the news mediums, because since the founding of our democracy, we've considered print journalism to be the very watchdog of our government and our society. So with this shrinkage, you know, how does that affect society?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you know, just a few years ago, the Knight Foundation, which is highly respected, issued a warning about there being a crisis among local journalistic institutions that serve democracy. And even the FCC a couple of years ago issued a warning in which they said in some cases journalism is at risk at the local level. This from a federal agency. What I worry about, Nikki, is the decline in beat reporting that's happening at a lot of news organizations. And just for example, take state houses. State house coverage is critical. It's the ultimate in accountability journalism. And, you know, I once worked in Illinois, where I think something like three of the last five governors have now gone to prison for various misdeeds. And that shows why state house reporting is so critical. But there was a report the American Journalism Review did just a few years ago, which showed that a third of statehouse reporters have been cut across the country, and that at virtually every statehouse in America, there were fewer reporters than there were years ago. I mean, that to me is alarming, and it's just one anecdotal bit of evidence of the decline of beat reporting across the country. In Washington, for example, you used to have reporters assigned virtually to every member of Congress, covering what they were doing, holding them accountable for what was happening back home. The number of those reporters has now been cut as well. So, and in Baltimore, you know, when I was editor of The Sun, we had a Pulitzer Prize finalist project on ground rent that was done back in 2008 about folks removing people from their homes for, in some cases, very little amount of ground rent that they owed on their houses. That was a project that took months and months to do, of really intense reporting. And I worry that the ability to do that, those in-depth projects, doesn't exist the way it did a few years ago, because, you know, that requires a lot of time and a lot of labor and a lot of expertise.
Right. I pick up The Sun and you see the same bylines, you know, covering so many different types of stories. I want to ask, you were at The Sun at a particularly tumultuous time financially. What were some of your top concerns as an editor with regards to the paper's future?
Sure. My big concern was maintaining the journalistic quality of The Sun and being able to do the kind of reporting, accountability reporting that I was just talking about with the ground rent series, at the same time that we had to rescale the business because revenues were declining so rapidly, especially in classified advertising. You mentioned Craigslist at the top of the show. Classified advertising was a real huge part of the revenue of The Sun and of most newspapers. And so, you know, when that all started declining quickly, the question was, how do you maintain aggressive investigative and accountability journalism with fewer resources? And that was really the balancing act that I was trying to maintain. And the other thing is, you know, there has to be a value proposition for people to send their hard-earned money in every month, every quarter, for that subscription. And how do you maintain that value proposition in the wake of declining resources? And now, for example, an increasing part of newspaper revenue is subscriber income from people paying more for the cost of their subscription. Well, you know, that subscriber to write that check every month has to feel like they're getting something for their money. So how do you preserve that?
Right. I want to talk, since we're talking about revenues, let's talk about paywalls. Before we got on the air, we talked about paywalls and how different publications are handling this. So tell us about the paywall experimentation. Are we beyond the experimentation phase? And how has it played out for different publications?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question, Nikki. It's different at different levels. I mean, at the national level, the models for success really are the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I was just reading the other day that the New York Times revenue for digital-only subscriptions was up 36% in 2013, 36%. And in the fourth quarter, they added something like 33,000 digital-only subscribers. And I think the Times now has something like 760,000 digital-only subscribers. The Wall Street Journal has about 900,000 digital-only subscribers. So at the national level, with those publications, that's premium content that people are willing to pay for. At the local level, it's still evolving. Something like 19% of all circulation revenue now comes from digital subscriptions across the U.S. And the previous year, I think it was like 14%. So that percentage is rising, and you're beginning to see more digital revenue come into newsrooms, which is the good news. But, you know, there also have been, at the local level, a lot of digital experiments that haven't worked. You know, Eric was talking about, you know, in the Washington area, you know, in 2011, they started TBD.com, a local news website, hired a lot of very good people, had a very talented editor. It was funded by All Britain, which owns Politico. Didn't make it. If you look at Patch.com, which was AOL's big experiment for hyper-local coverage, they had 900 local news websites across the country, and you know, they recently sold their majority interest. And the problem is, I mean, local reporting is very labor intensive, and so getting the revenue to support the labor to provide that content is tough.
Right. I want to ask you something that has been on my mind. Anytime we do a show related to newspapers, we'll get calls with people just who've had it with the Sun. They've seen the way it's changed. Just aesthetically, you know, it's gotten smaller, it's gotten thinner, and they don't see the investigative reporting. There is some amazing, let's just put it out there, there's some amazing investigative reporting that the Sun is doing, but we get a sense from the public that they're skeptical of where their paper is going. So is that a sense you get all across the country, that, you know, the public is just sort of looking for other ways to get their news?
I think they are looking for other ways. And even in the Pew report, I mean, it showed the impact of digital. I mean, a majority of Americans now use their mobile devices to get news. And I believe it might have been the first time that that crossed that threshold majority level for people getting news from mobile sites. You know, I still have a lot of friends at the Sun. There's a lot of talent there, and they're working very, very hard. And if you look at what they're doing, they're cranking out for multiple platforms. In the digital world, every millisecond counts. So they're writing 2-3 stories a day in addition to writing for the print edition. And so, they're working very, very hard to make a go of it. And so here's where I sort of come down in the next couple of years. The three biggest costs of newspapers are people, paper, and distribution. So if the distribution and paper costs of newspapers fall away because they're printing fewer copies and they're distributing fewer copies, what you're left with is the core of your news operation, and that's what you're selling. So I think newspapers can make a go of it, you know, over the next 2 or 3 years, with two of their three biggest cost centers, distribution and paper, either being eliminated or sharply cut back, and then digital revenues increasing to support news gathering. That, I think, you know, could be the business model of the future for newspapers, including the Sun.
I want to go back to that people part of the equation. Yeah. I was a community newspaper reporter myself when I started off in the industry many years ago. And the veteran reporters at my publication, they just had it. You know, they were being handed equipment, told to go out and make slideshows and be on Twitter, and there was no explanation because the management had no idea where the business was going. So with that said, the sentiment, the morale was not good at these businesses. How do managers, how are they dealing with that?
Well, I mean, you're right, and I've heard the same thing, and I've experienced the same thing. I think for managers, you know, they need to make the case for how they're going to grow the business and show folks a pathway to the future, you know, through digital. And the future is digital. I think we all know that. But you know, it can't just be cutting. And I mean, that in itself is not a strategy for survival. So I think there needs to be an articulated message for the future and for growth and what, you know, they're going to be doing. And I guess I would also say that, I mean, that at Poynter, we train people to make that bridge from print to digital. And there's never been a more important time to train journalists. I mean, you talked about just handing reporters video equipment and having them go off and do a story. That's really not, that's not a recipe for success either. So I think there needs to be an investment in the training side of the newsroom as well.
I want to ask you what I asked Eric about these hybrid news sites like the Baltimore Brew here in Baltimore. Where do you see them fitting in, and do you see their business model as sustainable?
I mean, I'm happy that they're there, and I think the Baltimore Brew is doing some admirable work for sure. You know, I just mentioned some of the local digital operations that haven't been able to financially sustain it. There also are success models, you know, the Texas Tribune in Texas, for example. There's also one in Oklahoma that I think is doing especially well. So I think the key is how, you know, do they start small and grow it incrementally, which tends to be more of a recipe for success for those sites. But if they're producing quality content that people are willing to pay for, and the latter part being the key there, then I think that, yeah, there could be sustainable business models. And also foundations and philanthropic organizations are increasingly beginning to fund local news startups. And while I don't think that, that they'll continue to fund their operations for a long time, I do think that's a way that they can start up, get going, try to get healthy, and then grow.
You're listening to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer, sitting in for Dan Rodericks, and we're discussing the health of our local newspaper industry with Tim Franklin, president of the Poynter Institute. I wanted to ask you about something that I find particularly alarming. The use of paid content by commercial advertisers that's being written by newspaper staffers, and this content is extremely hard to distinguish unless you are looking very carefully and reading between the lines from news and then paid content. So what is your thought on this? I guess it's a business model for sustaining newspapers, but it also seems very dangerous to me.
Yeah, you're talking about native advertising online?
Right, yes.
It's very controversial in the industry. And for example, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal were very skeptical about native advertising. Now it looks like, as I understand it, both of those organizations are either doing or will begin doing some native advertising. I mean, I think the key, Nikki, is how it's labeled. And if it's obviously advertising, and
it doesn't seem very transparent to me as a reader.
Yeah, well, that may be the problem. I think the key in all this is transparency. So if it's clearly labeled advertising, then I don't have a problem with it. I mean, there's advertising in newspapers. There's and there have been increasingly different kind of models for print advertising and placement of print ads, including on the front page and section fronts recently because of the revenue they bring in. But the native advertising trend, I think we need to move cautiously. I think we need to have very clear labeling of it. But I think you're going to be seeing more of it.
Do you think the public is savvy enough to understand that that is not an independent voice? This is not a journalism piece?
I think that's a great question. I think readers of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, if it's clearly labeled, probably will be able to distinguish. But if it's not clearly labeled and you're talking about smaller news organizations, then I think it gets much tougher.
I have one more question for you. You graduated from Indiana University. You've been in the newspaper business for what seems like forever, right? You worked at the Chicago Tribune, the Indianapolis Star, the Sun, the Sentinel. Would you go into print journalism today?
I would. My daughter is actually a journalism major in college, fully aware of all the challenges. I mean, I'm an optimist. I do think there's going to be a new business model that's going to emerge through digital that will become sustaining. And I don't look at these organizations as just print newspapers anymore. I mean, they really are multi-platform news organizations. But I think managers are going to have to become much more creative, much more aggressive, and willing to do some risk-taking to be successful going forward.
I guess one question I have, you know, people, really talented journalists like Ezra Klein over at The Post, you know, being lured to these digital sites. What are your thoughts on that? How are papers going to keep their talent?
Well, first of all, I think it's very exciting. And basically what you're seeing is individual journalists creating their own brands and then being able to market and sell their own brands, i.e. Nate Silver at 538 at ESPN, and you mentioned Ezra Klein, who's now at Vox Media. I think that, the Washington Post, where Ezra Klein just came from, will be able to continue to develop creative digital products that people will want to read. I mean, are they losses to those organizations? Yes, they are. But I think these are powerful. The Washington Post is still a very powerful brand name in that market that's going to be able to attract talent. And so, Ezra Klein is a huge loss, but I think the Post will go on, and I think they'll find someone else, maybe not as talented, but certainly talented, who will produce that blog.
What are your final thoughts on the status of the Baltimore print industry? What's your takeaway here?
I think what's happening there is what's happening in a lot of markets around the country. Baltimore's not immune. I have a lot of affection for the Sun. I have a lot of affection for the city. And am I concerned? Absolutely, about what's happening. Do I think they can come out the other side? Yes, I do. But I think it's going to take, as I was saying, a lot of creativity, to figure out the new business model.
All right, Tim Franklin, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today on Midday.
Thanks for having me.
That was Poynter Institute President Tim Franklin. He was the editor and senior vice president of the Baltimore Sun between 2004 and 2008. We have to take another break here, but when we come back, more on the health of the newspaper industry. Up next, we'll talk with two local college journalism seniors about what they think the future of American print journalism might hold. Stay with us. And welcome back to the Midday Show. I'm Nikki Gamer, sitting in for Dan Rodericks today. Dan will be back tomorrow. We're talking this hour about the health of our local newspaper industry, and we've touched on a lot, including what the future of American journalism might hold. Despite changes in print journalism, many students are graduating each year with the hope of getting jobs in the news. So I thought it would be useful, before we ended today's show, to hear from some local up-and-coming journalists about what they think could transpire within their chosen profession. Here with me now are two such journalists. Jen Ruckel ended her stint last week, as the editor-in-chief of The Greyhound, the student newspaper of Loyola University, Maryland. Jen Ruckel is a senior at Loyola and will graduate this spring. Jen Ruckel, welcome to the Midday Show.
Thanks, Nikki. Great to be here.
Also with me now is Mike King, a senior journalism major at the University of Maryland, College Park. Mike King is a stringer for The Sun, and he's the editor-in-chief of University of Maryland's newspaper, The Diamondback. Mike King, welcome to the Midday Show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
All right, so you're both seniors with great experience at your college papers. So, Jen Ruckel, we'll start with you. What jobs do you hope to get out there?
Well, I'm definitely hoping to go into journalism. I'm certainly not married to print journalism because, I mean, as we've talked earlier, the industry is in a really interesting place right now. And I think that the point of journalism is going to be figuring out how to do the same thing, but in a lot of different ways. Multimedia journalism is something that, has to be considered by any young person going into the industry, utilizing social media tools, and being willing to broaden your boundaries of the ways that you're going to do journalism in order to do the same profession well, I think.
Mike, what are your thoughts?
I have an internship this summer at Newsday, and I'm going to be doing copy editing, so that's a very traditional thing, and I don't feel like that's crazy of me to do. It's paid, so it seems like a good idea, and I've been interested in going into newspapers since I was a high schooler, and that hasn't changed, even with all of the facts about the industry that I've learned in the past couple of years.
I remember watching All the President's Men. I remember, Woodward and Bernstein, the sacred newsroom, as we've used this word, government watchdog. Is this something that you guys saw when you were younger, and did that idea of the newsroom inspire you to get into this profession? Jen, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, certainly. I've come to love and hate this profession at the same time, but it's something that, at the end of the day, you're going to be doing a lot of really hard work, and sometimes not with all the reward that you think that profession deserves, but you have to really believe in what you're doing and be willing to, to branch out of your comfort zone sometimes, to learn how different ways to do it right in order to get people to care about the great work that you're doing. Last summer, I worked at the Baltimore Sun. I had an internship on the copy desk, and it can be depressing sometimes. You hear stories of these old-time editors. My supervisor, his wife, bought him a Red Razor scooter for his 50th birthday to go up and down the newsroom because they had so many employees. And then when I was working there, you know, on a good day, there are 10 copy desks in action.
I can't remember. You said it was kind of like a ghost town.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I mean, you walk in, and I mean, I had the 4 to midnight shift, so it's a little bit of a ghost town anyway, but still, you know, that one floor was hopping, but there are a bunch of empty desks, and you hear all the stories of the yesteryears, and there's such good people trying to do this really, really great work, and they just don't have the resources that they once did.
Mike King, what do you take with that? You know, you hear, as Jen was saying, you hear about these veteran journalists and talking about yesteryear. How do you interpret those stories?
Well, I was at the Sun just this January, and I actually used that exact wording of ghost town. It feels weird to be in some of these places that once had foreign bureaus and now are struggling to cover Washington, D.C. I think that there's still an immense amount of talent in those newsrooms now and coming into those newsrooms, at least I hope. I hope that the talent that's in college right now, including me, is worthy of picking up that mantle. And I think that there's so much knowledge in those legacy media outlets that can be passed on to the next generation of journalists that they can't learn in college and they can't learn at BuzzFeed or TBD or Patch. I spent 3 weeks at the Sun, and it was one of the most educational experiences of my life. And I think that that knowledge and institutional memory is priceless, even if the company is worthless.
You both managed your own newspapers, the heads of your college newspapers. Mike, you're still there. Have you had discussions to go all digital, or are you still putting out print editions? And what is that conversation like? Jen, we'll start with you.
Sure. So last year, we actually were in an interesting bind. We are semi-independent. We don't pay to use our office space on campus, but we do pay entirely for the production cost of our newspaper. We used to be able to pay our staff. Unfortunately, we can't anymore, though they're still working 30-plus hour weeks on all the stories that they produce for us. And last year, our student activities office, which is kind of our publisher right now, came to us and said, we don't have the money to print your paper anymore. You got to get creative. So we used a cool online site called Issue. We developed a WordPress site. And through that, we learned to be really creative about getting people to still want to read the content that we produce. But at the same time, it's really frightening because you have to weigh these options of, you know, are we going to keep being scrappy, find these creative solutions, or are we going to go to the school and say, hey, we're going to take money from you? And then suddenly, you know, we don't always write sunshine and rainbows about the administration of Loyola. And if that were to be compromised, to me, that would be the biggest failure. I would rather have to work harder to get people to pay attention to what we're saying and do it in a really ethical way that we still stand behind using those online solutions. Luckily, right now, we're back in print. Our business manager is keeping us afloat, but it's still sad to say that there's no way we can compensate the staff that they work so hard and they really believe in this. So it's frustrating, certainly.
So it's very real-world problems. Mike King, what about you?
The Diamondback is going through many similar problems. We also use Issue, and we've been working hard to update our website. We're in talks as of today about some significant changes to the website. And over the past few years, pay has been cut for our staff members pretty significantly. And this past year, at the start of the academic year, we cut our print edition on Fridays because it was the least read edition and it had the least amount of advertising. And so it was sort of an experiment to have one foot in the digital world and one foot still in the print world. So we print daily issues Monday to Thursday, but on Thursday night, everybody in the newsroom isn't working on the print paper. They're working on just the website and trying to create interactive elements and galleries and polls and all of these things that take time but give the reader a greater experience when they're reading in a digital form. And our Friday editions have been really successful, at least from the metric side of things. And also at the Society of Professional Journalists Region 2 Mark of Excellence Awards this past weekend. We won some online awards, so that was a good validation. And I've heard a lot of positive feedback about it, but it still is never necessarily a good thing to get rid of some aspect of the publication. We're independent, too. We don't get any funding from the university, and we're entirely ad-supported. And like every other newspaper since about 2009, we have been really struggling with ad revenue, and it's just getting worse. Digital ad revenue is starting to take up the place of print revenue, but it's still nowhere near fully replacing it.
Sure.
And
can I ask you, do you know how students are reading the paper? Are they looking at your print edition? Are they looking online? Where are they going?
We have statistics for all of those things, and one of the most shocking things to me this semester is that our page views from desktops or laptops, things with physical keyboards, I guess, those are down, but our mobile page views are way up, way up, and it's the biggest increase I've ever seen. So it's a mixed bag, but I think that it's a positive.
Jen, how about you?
I mean, we've heard mostly anecdotal evidence from students that when the print newspaper disappears, they think the Greyhound newspaper has disappeared. However, we've taken on a couple of social media editors recently and our web editor, and they've been really working to fuse those two mediums to create something that students are more, you know, it's more in their daily life.
Do these students, are they going to the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun? Are they buying the paper? Does anybody buy the paper anymore, the physical paper? Mike King?
We had a college readership, what was called the college readership program here at the University of Maryland for years, where there were free copies of USA Today, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. And it was canceled for money reasons and readership reasons a couple of years ago. And they recently brought back just the New York Times. And almost every time I've seen that rack of free New York Times, all of them have been gone. So at least people are picking up the 100 or so in that individual rack that I happen to see.
Jen, how about you?
I can't say the same for Loyola. I pay for New York Times online subscription, even though we have free stacks of them all over campus. So I'm a little hypocritical there, but we have USA Today, The Sun, The Times, in stacks all over campus. And most of the time you see those stacks pretty full.
Everybody's on their iPhones, I guess. I want to ask, what do you see? We only have a couple minutes left. In brief, what do you see for the future of print journalism? Do you see it going the way of the passenger pigeon here? Mike King, what do you see?
I don't think it's going to end, but I think we're seeing a major irreversible shift. I'm working on a lot of things for American Journalism Review here at the University of Maryland, and it's unmistakable that we're entering a period of permanent change for the journalism industry. And I don't think it's a matter of every newspaper is eventually going to die, but I think every newspaper really has to think seriously about a digital-only future and what that means for every aspect of the publication. And I think it's irresponsible to not do that.
Jen Ruckel?
I completely agree. I think that it's going to really be about getting creative, figuring out how to fund the print if you want the print to still exist. And that might mean taking sponsored stories or taking, you know, different types of ad revenue than you had gotten in the past. And while that can be a little unsettling, coming from the background of what the foundation of journalism is supposed to be, but at the same time, I think that the print, it really does have a place in our lives, and I truly don't believe that it's going to die out completely. It's certainly going to change. And I agree that the responsible decision is to figure out all of the different ways that you can still get this journalism to the people, because that's what's most important, I think, at the end of the day.
Well, it's nice to end the show on some positive notes and some optimism. Well, Jen Ruckel, Mike King, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck out there in the journalism job market.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Jen Ruckel, a senior at Loyola University, Maryland, and the outgoing editor-in-chief of that school's student newspaper, The Greyhound. Also with me was Mike King, a senior at the University of Maryland and editor-in-chief of their student newspaper, The Diamondback. I'm Nikki Gamer. That's it for our first hour today. We break now for lunch, brought to us on Mondays by Atwaters. Atwaters supports local radio, local farmers, and local appetites. Coming up after the news at 1, it's an encore broadcast of Dan's conversation with evolutionary biologist Alon Dekados. He talks about his book, The Monkey's Voyage, and other journeys that helped shape the history of life. Stay with us.